You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome all to to the Carnegie Endowment, to this meeting on Turkey after June 12th elections, challenges and opportunities. We have three speakers, including myself. I'm both going to be chair and exercise great discipline over myself and my colleagues. But that said, we have three people, Steve Cook, Ömer Taşpınar, and myself. Steve is with the Council on Foreign Relations. Ömer is with both the National Defense University in Brookings, and I'm with Lehigh University and Carnegie. And you have the bios, so I'm not going to go over the bios. Please, before we start, turn off your cell phones, any other gadgets you may have. And we'll start with Steve, Ömer, and then myself, and then we'll open it up to questions. Let me also say that we have a few slides to show you. We'll have them. The first one, they'll stay there. This one will stay. It shows you essentially the comparison between three election results in terms of the which party won which districts, 2002, 2007, 2011. Here you see the results of the 2002 elections in terms of percentages of votes and number of seats. We couldn't put them all on one slide, so I have them as separate. And 2011. And then this is the last election. So I will leave this one, and I'll periodically play with it and show you the others to distract you from our comments. Well, with that, Steve will start. Steve?
Thanks very much, Henry. Let me start out with just two quick statements, one, both of which are caveats. One, I recognize some folks from the previous two events on Turkey's elections that I've done. So I promised one of those that I will not use the same jokes and quips. And my friend Kareem Sajapur has told me that I've done one too many of these. So I will keep my, even though Henri is
Kareem Omer, is wise.
Henri and Omer will speak for 10 minutes. I'll keep my remarks truncated since many of you have heard them all already. That said, let me just repeat myself, I guess. Clearly, the outcome of the elections were not a surprise. Although AKP did get 50%, and if any of you were paying attention to Blogging Heads TV in the last couple of weeks, I predicted a much lower total outcome. But it was clearly an impressive victory for AKP, even though their seat totals have diminished. And it's abundantly clear that Prime Minister Erdogan and the party can come away from these elections anytime you get 50% of the vote, believing very strongly that they have a new mandate, a renewed mandate, and that the policies of the course of the last 4 years, whether it's domestic, foreign, or economic policies, are clearly vindicated by the outcome of the elections. As far as the CHP totals, there's been much discussion of CHP's desire to reach the 30% or more threshold. I think that was largely an unrealistic goal for a party that was had a new leader for the course of the last year or so. And I think that if I was Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, I'd be pretty happy with my 5% pickup. But CHP is a party that is desperately in need not just of reinventing its leadership, but reinventing itself as a whole. Clearly, post-Kemalist AKP has done extremely, extremely well, has been able to run the political arena virtually on its own over the course of the last 9 years, which makes it historic in and of itself. And if CHP is going to hope to compete going forward, it's going to have to undergo something much more thoroughgoing than the leadership change that occurred last May. I think I will focus my remarks on foreign policy aspects. I've been asked recently, what do these election results mean for U.S.-Turkey relations? And my answer is pretty much nothing. I think as long ago as 10 or 11 months ago, people in the administration understood that there was a very, very strong possibility that AKP was going to win these elections. And despite the firestorm over the Mavi Marmara incident and the no vote in the UN Security Council, that Washington was seeking to repair relations, if only because there was a recognition that the Obama administration would need to work with the AKP, Prime Minister Erdogan, and Foreign Minister Davutoğlu going forward, at the very least for the rest of President Obama's term, and then on to, hopefully, from their perspective, a second term. But I think that more broadly, there will continue to be a discussion in Washington about the Justice and Development Party and the trajectory of Turkey's domestic politics and what that means for Turkey's foreign policies. And I think that, and this is something that I emphasized in another meeting yesterday, that I think that there is a struggle going on. I think that Americans need to recognize that while there is an ideological component to AKP's approach to the world, that there really are a number of other stronger determinants and incentives for Turkey's novel foreign policy. My friend and colleague Omer Taşmina has talked about it eloquently as the normalization of Turkish foreign policy. And this is, I think, essentially what a foreign policy that is largely determined by economic interests, a more open and democratic Turkey, and a Turkey that is, like we all are, but is seeing new opportunities in a very changed global environment. And what I'm talking about here is still the after effects of the end of the Cold War 20 years on. And I think that what is the debate here and the struggle here for Americans, both policymakers as well as those of us on the outside who spend a lot of time looking at Turkey, is the evolution of Turkey from a client state to a partner. And can that happen? How do we make that happen? How do we leverage Turkey's attributes in both its immediate region and elsewhere that we can work together? My own sense is that in some discrete areas that will be not at all problematic. In other areas, we will clearly have our differences, and we'll either have to work them out or work around each other. But I think incumbent upon both countries is to build a cushion into our relations so that things like the Mavi Marmara incident or the no vote in the UN Security Council, as important, as crucially important as that no vote was and how difficult a moment that was, that if there was a cushion beyond the kind of traditional issues in U.S.-Turkey relations, let's say, for example, on energy issues or cooperation in development, economic cooperation in the Middle East, for example, would be the kinds of things that would cushion the relationship and institutionalize the relationship further beyond, as I said, NATO, EU, and the other traditional issues that have come up in U.S.-Turkey relations. That by no means, this moving from client state to partnership is by no means a settled issue. And I think that it will continue to be a struggle between the two countries. And there will continue to be, I think, a robust debate here in Washington about precisely what the AKP's victories mean for the future of both Turkey and the future of U.S.-Turkey relations. Let me switch very briefly and talk a bit about the Arab Spring, because I know a number of the things that I've been writing recently about the Arab Spring has not made me the most popular person in Ankara these days. And let me just get it off my chest once again. Is the sense that I have that the Turks, despite telling us for the better part of 10 years that they had a special insight into the Middle East, that they understood local conflicts better than the United States, that they, because of important historical and cultural ties, were better positioned than Washington to be a regional leader, proved really not to be the case in this season of upheaval. Now, the Turks aren't to be blamed for this. Everybody was disoriented and confused and experienced extreme cognitive dissonance when these uprisings swept the region. But what is clear is that Turkey, despite talking about how it had some sort of special insight, is that its primary interests, its economic and foreign policy interests, were as wrapped up in the old order as were those of the United States or other countries in the region. The Turks quite clearly have moved from their early positions with regard to Libya and moving rapidly away from the Assad regime in Syria. But these the loss of Assad in Syria in particular is going to be both a diplomatic issue for the Turks as well as a national security issue for Turkey. What it does, though, is that it clarifies things, I think, and in an odd, unintended way, clarifies for us and for the Turks precisely where they lie. It's been clear for a long time that there is a competition between Ankara and Tehran in Iraq. There is quickly emerging a competition between Ankara and Tehran in Syria. This is something that the Syrians have actually understood, that if there were to ever be a crisis, the only country that they could really rely on were the Iranians. So I think that this, in an odd, as I said, in an odd and unintended way, is a clarifying moment and actually forces Turkey into a position to which Americans are likely to be much more comfortable with going forward. And then let me just say to close on this question of, you know, is Turkey a model? Is Turkey an inspiration? What role does Turkey really have in this region? Let me start out by saying that it was relatively easy to play a kind of constructed and influential role in the Middle East when the Arab world was politically dead. But as we've seen since December, when upheaval began in Tunisia and then subsequently spread throughout the region, that there is a lot of political dynamism now in the region. And I think that certain groups in the Arab world certainly have things to learn from the Turks. I think that the elections the other day were a prime example of the kinds of things that Arabs can learn. But by and large, these uprisings are about Arab empowerment and the ability of Arabs to write their own history. And as much as they can learn from the Turkish experience, we'll be looking inward to build new, more decent political systems. I think the lasting and most important means of influence or way that Turkey can be most helpful to the region around it is on the economic front. Clearly, Turkey is an economic powerhouse. There is a lot of economic dynamism in Turkey. It can be an engine of growth for the entire region. And the rise of Turkey as a trading state is one of the most important things to happen in the region over the course of the last 10 years. And it could be something that can help propel the Middle East in a direction that is a more prosperous one going forward. That is, though, a long-term issue. The upheavals in the Arab world are not going to settle down in 3, 6, 9 months. We're talking years down the road. And during those years, Turkey can play a leading role. But if a country like Egypt, for example, can become politically and economically successful, it will diminish Turkey's role because Egypt is a quarter of the Arab world, and Arabs will quite naturally look to Cairo, as they have historically, for leadership. That's not to suggest that Turkey would have to retreat from the region, but that there will be another very large, important, and influential country that will, for a variety of reasons, perhaps eclipse Turkey in terms of where Arabs are looking for inspiration. I'll leave it at that and then hand it over to my two very capable friends.
Thank you. Ömer?
I'll also offer some brief observations about the election and then conclude with foreign policy. Just to give you a sense of proportion about this victory, you all know that it's the third time that AKP has won. The last time a political party has won 3 consecutive elections in Turkey was under Adnan Menderes in the 1950s. But the difference this time, which makes it a first into Turkish Republic's history, is that after each election, the AKP's vote increased. That was not the case with Adnan Menderes. So each time, the party received more votes. This doesn't reflect itself in the parliament. In 2002, they had more seats. In 2007, they had less seats. And now they have even less seats. That's because the number of parties entering the Turkish parliament changes based on the 10% threshold. In 2002, I think MHP was not in. And also there are a number of independent candidates that made it to the parliament this time, and they're mostly from the Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party. So that's one reason why the big 50% electoral victory, it's not fully reflected in the number of seats won by AKP. To give you another sense of proportion about this victory, think about the city of Istanbul. Istanbul's population is roughly correspond to Greece and Bulgaria combined. So it's heading towards 18 million. So you basically have a city like Istanbul that is under the leadership of Tayyip Erdogan and basically AKP since 1994. So for 17 years, this party has been running a city that is larger than countries in Europe, and they're still winning. So I think it is time to ask why. Why is AKP, after all these years, is still able to win? And I think the simple answer is the economy is stupid. The economy is doing well. It's very difficult for an opposition party, even if it had brilliant charismatic leadership, even if it had no structural problems like the CHP does, to really challenge such an economy. Because people, like everywhere in democracies, vote mostly about bread and butter issues. We can discuss identity problems, we can discuss secularism, authoritarianism, but at the end of the day, the man in the street cares about the economy. And the fact that Turkey, in the last 10 years, has doubled its income per capita, according to purchasing power parity, even tripled. The fact that inflation is much lower than the 1990s, the lost decade of the 1990s. The fact that this party, despite the rise of corruption in the last few years, is still able to provide efficient socio-economic services, especially at the municipalities, is the big story here. Healthcare reform is a big success in Turkey. It's underreported in the Western media. People who go to hospitals in Turkey actually get very good services and affordable housing. All these are the main reasons why AKP is winning. So we have to look at the economy in order to understand why this political party is so successful. Now, the fact that the AKP did not get a supermajority, in my opinion, is a good thing. Because despite this big success story in the economy, the country is polarized at the political level. And there were fears that Prime Minister Erdogan had an agenda to push for a presidential regime in Turkey. Without 367 seats, without the two-thirds supermajority, he will basically have to put to rest his ambition to become the president of the country in a presidential system. He may still decide to become the president, depending on when Abdullah Gül's term will end. But I think this fearful scenario, which led the Economist and I think the Western media to say, vote for CHP, that he was going to push with a supermajority for a presidential regime, is no longer there. Instead, the AKP will have to focus on the most urgent problem of the country, and that's not Syria, that's not foreign policy, it's the Kurdish question. As you look at the map, Turkey's map, you will see that the eastern provinces, predominantly Kurdish, are no longer AKP lands. The AKP is the second party. The independents of the Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party have won probably a more impressive victory than AKP itself. Everyone was predicting that the AKP would win between 45-50%. But I think very few people predicted that BDP with independents would have 36 members of parliament. This tells you something, because the BDP, in the eyes of most Turks, in the eyes of most Turks who are patriotic, nationalist Turks, is the political wing of the PKK. The fact that the political wing of the PKK is able to win such majorities, the fact that they are pushing for 7%, is a big story. And it shows that we have reached a critical point vis-à-vis the Kurdish question in Turkey. So In my opinion, the most urgent task of AKP will be to address this question. I'm sure Henri will talk more about it, but I think the Prime Minister's tactic, his nationalist turn in the last year after the failure of the Kurdish opening in 2010, was not a good sign. This was not the Tayyip Erdogan of 2005-2006. He was playing a very nationalist game and had adopted a very nationalist narrative. Now he will have to change course. And for liberal Democrats in Turkey who supported AKP because it was pro-European Union, pro-solution on the Kurdish question, pro-multiculturalism, trying to basically change the kind of hardcore Kemalist nature of the regime, this was a disappointment to see Tayyip Erdogan, even less progressive than the CHP on the Kurdish problem, was a disappointment. So the big question that I have today is whether he will be able to change course, whether he will be able to embrace elements of the opposition, be it in the independent opposition, BDP, be it at the CHP, to change the constitution, to change, for instance, articles related to the nature of Turkish citizenship, articles related to education, whether bilingual education will be possible in Turkey, whether Turkey will be able to take steps towards a more decentralized system. Those are the big challenges facing AKP. And so the constitutional agenda is, I think, the most important issue here. The economy, despite the rosy story that I painted myself, is also showing signs of overheating. So I think there will have to be concerns about what will happen to the current account deficit. That's another issue at the domestic level that the party should be worried about. The victories, as I argued, are based on the economy, and Erdogan's popularity is not just his charisma. He's very charismatic, but without 9% growth, such a victory would not have been possible. So can Turkey continue with 9% growth? Can it continue with a current account deficit that has reached 8% of the GDP? And here I have my doubts. And the minute the Turkish economy drops, I think the popularity of the AKP will also drop. Just to give you an evidence, in 2008, when Turkey had local elections, the economy was not in very good shape. 2008, remember, was the year when the global financial crisis was having an impact on Turkey, and Turkey's growth rate had dropped actually to 3%, and unemployment had an uptick. And in the local elections of 2008, AKP received 38%, 12% less than today. So if we have in the next 4 or 5 years a major drop in the growth rate, if the current account deficit, which is growing, creates a crisis, if the capital flows that are flowing to Turkey sense that there is political risk in Turkey, be it related to the Kurdish problem or any kind of political issue, then AKP may face a much stronger opposition. That will be the time when Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and CHP will have a better chance of challenging the party. Finally, just a couple words about foreign policy. I think Steve is right. Turkey, up until today, was able to fill in the Middle East a strategic vacuum. The vacuum was essentially because of the absence of Egypt as a major player. Now, Egypt is back. Slowly, but Egypt is back. It was Egypt that brokered the deal between Fatah and Hamas, not Turkey. Turkey tried very hard to broker that deal in 2009, 2010. Egypt had a much easier time doing it. That tells you something, that basically, with Egypt back, it's no longer business as usual in the Middle East. The real model for the Middle East will not be Turkey, but Egypt. Al Jazeera is following Egypt much more closely than Turkey. It is an Arab country, and people look at Arab dynamics. Turkey is still a kind of exotic, enigmatic country for the Arab world. So I agree with Steve that Turkey is not really likely to benefit so much from the Arab Spring. There will be a new strategic leadership in the region, and I think Turkey will have to basically realize that the days when it was able to play the leadership for the Arab Street are over. On the Syrian front, Now the Arab Spring has taken a very bloody turn, and the crisis is on Turkey's borders. What will Turkey do with Syria? Does Turkey have leverage with Damascus? I think the prime minister is playing a delicate, high-wire balance acting game where Turkey is hosting opposition conference. At the same time, he's able to talk to Bashar Assad about the need for reforms. He's personally very disappointed, I think, the prime minister, to see that he has limited leverage with Damascus. When the issue is regime survival for Assad, I don't think they're in a mood to listen to Washington, to Ankara. Regime survival is the most important issue, and if it's necessary, the regime will continue to kill protesters. And I don't think the Western community, the United Nations sanctions, et cetera, have much leverage with Syria. In that sense, this causes a major problem for Turkey, because Syria was the cornerstone of Turkey's zero problems foreign policy. I'm not one of those who argues that this is the bankruptcy of Turkey's foreign policy vis-a-vis the region. No, I think Turkey did the right thing by engaging Syria in the last 8 years. It was not expecting this kind of turn of events, but it's definitely a major problem now in terms of Turkish leverage, and it shows to people like Foreign Minister Davutoğlu that Turkey's soft power, Turkey's leverage, Turkey's influence, its strategic depth has serious limits. One word about Turkey-US. I think there is some momentum on the Armenia-Azerbaijan front. If there is a roadmap for Nagorno-Karabakh, I think there will be growing pressure on this government to pass the protocols for normalization with Armenia. This is something that Ahmet Davutoğlu, I think, wants. This is something that is urgent for Turkish-American relations. And in addition to developments in Armenia, I think we should be also following U.S. demands for NATO missile defense. That's also an important, urgent issue in Turkish-American relations. And it would surely be nice if there is a creative formula found to put Turkish-Israeli relations back on track. But at this point, this may be wishful thinking, because I think the result of these elections show that Turkey has self-confidence. Turkey is not ready to really compromise. An apology and compensation is still part of the Turkish talking points. I'll just stop here and be happy to answer questions later.
Thank you, Ömer. The problem of going third is that everything has been said in some ways, but you haven't heard it from everybody. So, and also not with my accent. So anyway, well, I will, as I was listening to my two colleagues, I was furiously trying to restructure and reshape my comments so I would not repeat some of the things. But let me just do an analysis of the elections and also talk about the winners and the losers and what's going to happen afterwards, what are the issues that will be salient in as we go into the third reign of the AKP. First of all, there's no question that there were two winners in this election. One was the AKP, obviously. It won 50% of the vote and a majority of the seats. And the other one was the Kurdish party, the BDP. And I would like to address both of these victories and contrast them essentially with the main opposition party to begin with. As you heard from Ömer, this was the third election that, and the first time since the 1950s that the Turkish party has won elections, consecutive elections as an incumbent. I mean, that's a difficult feat for most governments in most democratic societies. And it was the economy that essentially determined the outcome. I mean, and the AKP in some ways is very lucky because it is benefiting from the fruits of the labor that in the 1980s, the reforms that were introduced by Turgut Özal that are now paying off. Turkey is a major trading state. It is exporting like mad, and as a result, there is a great deal of more prosperity. That said, the irony, of course, of these elections, I think, is that this victory of AKP could have been actually much larger And in many ways, the AKP, which ran a pitch-perfect campaign, I mean, when I say pitch-perfect campaign, in every locality, the party was present, did door-to-door campaigning, and even ministers, which were dispatched to their home provinces, went door-to-door. I mean, this is, you have to understand, quite unusual in Turkey, where ministers tend to think of themselves as Olympian gods. And so for them to go door-to-door, just like we do in this country, shows you essentially how AKP looks at elections and how it perceives itself as a political party. It is a mass party. By contrast, the Republican People's Party has never done that. It has always campaigned at 30,000 feet and hoped that its message, which gets delivered through the airwaves, through television, through the radio and media, would somehow make it to the local level. So from that perspective, AKP had a tremendous advantage in terms of organization, in terms of running this election. However, Erdogan, at the very end, made a strategic error. And that is that he decided to figure out a way, in order to increase the number of seats in parliament, to push a nationalist action party below the 10% threshold. As you know, Turkey has a 10% threshold that you need to make in order to win, to get into parliament. If you win 9.9% of the vote nationwide, you will not get any seats in parliament. So to some extent, this also explains why you have such a divergent series of numbers between your share of the national vote and your share of the parliamentary seats. So he assumed, and he went after with a very nationalist discourse. He went after the Kurds, thinking that if he was hard on the Kurds, that MHP supporters, who tend to be mostly Turkish nationalists, very afraid of the Kurdish movement, very afraid of any compromises that may happen on the question of the Kurds, would gravitate to him. And that turned out to be a mistake. It turned out to be a mistake on two levels. One, because in some ways he alienated people. But on the other hand, the other one is that part of this campaign, and I'm not sure who released this, there were all kinds of compromising tapes that were, no, this was not Wiener, by the way, but all kinds of compromising video cassettes or CDs that came out about the Nationalist Action Party that created a backlash among the people, in the sense it's a sympathy vote. And it created also people who were not focusing on the Nationalist Action Party suddenly started to think about the Nationalist Action Party and started wondering whether or not it would be a good thing or a bad thing if this party did not make it through the 10% threshold. Because until Erdogan started to push this nationalist card, MHP was hovering around 10%. It could very easily not have made it. And there are some analysts who say it would not have made it had it not been for the fact that the Erdogan strategy of going using the nationalism card and the release of those compromising tapes essentially ensure that the MHP came into parliament. This will have certain consequences. Now I'll address them in a minute. But by and large, look, I mean, this was in a very professional campaign, exceedingly well executed. And even critics of AKP, even ferocious critics of the AKP, essentially admit to that fact. The other victor, as I said, is the BDP. Why is it a victor? I mean, you know, people, you have, the Turkish electoral system is actually a complex one, and it's very, the kind of professionalism that you see within the AKP in terms of running an election was also duplicated by the BDP. And in some ways, they were working under much harder, much more difficult conditions. Why? Because if the BDP decided it could not make the 10% threshold, so it decided to run independent candidates. When you run independent candidates, and you get elected in Turkey on the basis of provinces, so you have to calculate how many independent candidates you can elect in one province. If you have too many independent candidates, most of them would lose, and you won't be able to get enough seats in. If you have too few, your people will garner too many seats and too many votes, but you could have received more seats. So they had to calculate very carefully how many candidates they would run in the provinces, and then they had to go and to the electorate and say, you will vote for candidate A. You will vote for candidate B, because you don't want everybody to vote for one candidate. So it is a very delicate and very, very difficult way of running an election. And on top of this, you are a party that is kind of ostracized. You're a party that doesn't have any resources. And you're a party that essentially, when actually you look at this map, it doesn't say, but in each of these elections, the Kurdish party ran under a different name because the parties keep getting closed down by the constitutional court. So under very different circumstances, they won 36 seats, and remember the number of the votes they got, which is about 6%+, is mostly for where they ran the candidates. There are many provinces in which they did not offer candidates. So we don't know what the total of their vote would have been. So the potential is much higher. And the argument is that if you get rid of the 10% threshold or bring it down to 5%, Kurdish party will probably increase its support maybe up to 10%. The other thing that the Kurds did this time is that they opened up the party to, first of all, to the left. They created a coalition with left-wing parties. And they also opened up the party to Kurds who have been critics of both of themselves, of the Kurdish party, as well as the PKK, including bringing people who were targeted in the past by the PKK as being traitors, etc. So they essentially opened up the party to many more viewpoints, and that's also helped them to get all the seats. So when you look at the new parliament, yes, you have four political parties, but in reality, you have two very strong parties and two very relatively weak parties. When you look at the Republican People's Party, yes, they increased their vote from 21% to 26%, and they increased the number of seats they could. But when you look at the map, look how limited the Republicans, CHP, especially, and compare it essentially with 2002, 2007, 2008. There's a way in which geographically it's getting pushed to a smaller and smaller part of the country. Right, so it's becoming more of a regional party, just like maybe the Kurdish party appears to you as a regional party if you look at the 2011 results. So AKP now dominates the country. You know, it's never good to have one party dominate. Important impact of the AKP finally making the 50% threshold is that it's going to take away also from this canard of an argument that the opposition had in the past, which is, oh, but look, the majority of the country votes against the AKP, so they're really a minority party that rules the country. That was never the case. I mean, the electoral system is a screwed up electoral system, so it produces these results. But the fact of the matter is, now with 50% of the vote, nobody can make that argument. And there's no, in a way, what this election does is legitimizes once and for all the AKP beyond any shadow of a doubt, even in the minds of the opposition. But let me go back to the CHP, the Republican People's Party. There's a way in which the new leader came in with a lot of good intentions. He was unlucky in the sense that the elections came on him very quickly. He wanted to change the way the party runs elections, and in that sense was successful. I mean, there's no question that he injected a great deal of dynamism. People worked much harder. They were enthused. They were charged by the new leadership. But he still came up short. And he came up short of, in many ways, of, as you know, in this country as well, when it's expectations, especially in primaries, that matter. And everybody expected he was going to get 30%. In the end, he ended up with 26%. And as a result, what we're seeing now, 2 days after the elections, is the bloodletting has started. The people he had, the old leadership is now going, has taken out the long knives out for him. And in many ways, the reason I think it's a much weakened party is because now this party is going to be completely consumed by internecine fighting. The National Action Party, which made it into parliament, essentially must be feeling good because they made it in despite the fact that everybody had written them off and written their obituary. So in that sense, they may feel good. But in reality, it's a party that has no gravitas. It has only one issue, and that is to protect and Turkish nationalism and essentially be a roadblock to reforms on the Kurdish issue. It has no other agenda. It has no economic plan. It has no social plan. It has no social health or education plan. It has nothing to offer except that nationalist idea. So in that sense, it's a one-issue party that does not command a great deal of support and gravitas. So, looking into the future, the most important issue that's coming up is obviously the constitution. Erdogan did promise before the elections that there was going to be a new constitution. After the elections and his victory speech, he reiterated and spent a long time on the constitution, and he promised it would be a process. It would seek a process of consensus. The fact that he did not get the two-thirds majority or 330 seats, which would have enabled him to send a constitutional draft to the referendum, means that he will have to seek a compromise, and he should. I mean, in fact, the constitution should not be written just by parliament, but they have to bring in civil society groups, business groups, other actors. There's a great deal of, I mean, people may disagree about the content, but there's one thing that's there's no doubt about is that everybody in Turkey wants a new constitution. This constitution is a straitjacket. This constitution has blocked Turkey's progress. This constitution's and the laws that accompany it have essentially created a dysfunctional system we have a very dysfunctional system, too, so we shouldn't really throw many stones since we live in a glass house. But nonetheless, I mean, clearly there are many problems that the Turks have to solve, the most important being the Kurdish question, and that for that you need a new constitution. But that constitutional process is going to be a difficult one. It's going to take time. You don't write a constitution overnight, and you will need to get input from all the different. And here, what's interesting is that both the main supporter and the main opposition in parliament to the AKP will be the Kurds with their 36 seats, because they will push very hard, because that's what they ran on. That's why the message they sent to their electorate was: look, you have to vote for me because now is the important moment. Now there's going to be a new constitution. So if you want your voice and your rights to be heard, you have to vote for me. So that for them, that's the most important issue, and they will fight for that. At the same time, the AKP needs their support in terms of in parliament, especially in terms of pushing legislation to make it look wider. What is interesting is what the main opposition party, the Republican People's Party, will do. They have two choices. In the past, they have essentially resisted everything that the AKP has offered. Kılıçdaroğlu has signaled, at least during the electoral campaign, that he's much more open to a liberal constitution, to a change. And therefore, if he survives, and I have no idea at the moment if he will survive. But let's assume that he survives. He has an opportunity to essentially run to the liberal left, if you want, of the AKP by saying, look, yes, we need a new constitution. We want also a new constitution. We want a liberal constitution. And here's our suggestion. Right, and make put AKP on the defensive instead of and force AKP to come towards it. If it does that, then it will also be able to change the perception that exists in the country about the AKP. About the Republican People's Party, and at the same time, potentially increase its votes. It is in many ways vital that the Republican People's Party become a mass party and start challenging the AKP. One may like or may not like the AKP. That's irrelevant. But in any society, you need to have an opposition party that has a chance of winning. And when you look at these election results and you look at the way the AKP dominates, in many ways, this doesn't augur well on a purely, shall we say, political science perspective, does not augur well for Turkish democracy, because when you have a one-party state, you end up having essentially Caudillo-type politics. And it's only natural that a leader who wins election after election after election will also find himself or herself to be, above everything. And to some extent, we are seeing that with Erdogan's behavior. So the election, so the constitution is going to be the main game from now on. And it's going to be interesting to watch how this plays itself out. But it is also critical. And AKP in 2007 won, again, a significant victory, had lots of seats in parliament, talked about changing the constitution, had a draft constitution prepared, and then shied away. This time, it doesn't have it doesn't have an excuse. It has no option but to go forward, in part because the expectations have been built up in Turkish society, especially among Kurds. And if it doesn't happen, then all hell can break loose. And with that, I'll stop. And I won't talk about foreign policy since my colleagues did that. I can answer questions. Thank you. And when I recognize you, please identify who you are. Barbara.
Barbara Slavin from the Atlantic Council. The one country you didn't talk about in terms of foreign policy is Iran. Do these results have anything to do with Turkish policy toward Iran? Do you anticipate any renewed effort on the nuclear front, or do you think that was such a debacle in terms of the UN vote and the negative publicity and so on that that's going to be put aside? They're going to focus on Kurdish issues, Syria, other more immediate problems. Thank you.
Sure, I'll take it. I think that overall the election results reflect a vindication of AKP's foreign policies. And by and large, the argument in Turkey is not about foreign policy. Certainly, the CHP would like to see a more kind of emphasis on Atlanticism and believing that the AKP has lost that. But they're very proud of the role that everybody's proud of the role that Turkey has been playing in the region. So I wouldn't necessarily make any kind of direct linkage between Iran policy. I do think, though, that the Turks felt somewhat burned on the TRR deal and the position that they put themselves in as a result of the UN Security Council vote. I remember speaking with a number of AKP parliamentarians shortly after that, and I think that there was a recognition that they had some work to do and that was perhaps they'd been led down the garden path by Lula or others within Turkey who had grand ideas about the role that Turkey could play on this issue. And I think that, quite honestly, right now, the Turks have bigger issues on the plate. And as I mentioned, I think the Arab Spring has become a clarifying moment on a number of levels. And one of those is quite clearly where Turkey stands, given where, for all whatever problems and faults and concerns we may or may not have about AKP, where AKP ultimately stands on some critical issues, and in most particular, most immediate at the moment, is Syria. And that is where clearly Tehran and Ankara on opposite ends, in addition to Tehran and Ankara being on opposite ends in Iraq. So going forward, obviously there's a desire there to have a relationship, not to have significant friction, but I think you're bumping up against the hard realities of the region right now, where they're bound to come into, if not conflict, but certainly be strategic competitors in some important places.
I think foreign policy was unbelievably absent in this elections. So I don't remember any of the leaders mentioning once the European Union, for instance. We didn't talk about the European Union. Obviously, there is nothing to talk. So Iran, to a certain degree, one would expect that it would come up, but it did not. Even Syria, where basically you had all this mayhem, was not really big in the news. Turkey is a very self-centered country. But looking ahead, I think if Steve's analysis and my analysis that AKP's comparative advantage is no longer the leadership of the Arab street, AKP will have to look at what is its new mission in the Middle East. It can, I think Egypt will be the kind of leader in the Palestinian cause, but I think Turkey has one advantage, and it is its ability to transcend the Sunni-Shiite divide in the Middle East. What we have seen, which was not really, I think, noticed in the Western media, is that Tayyip Erdogan went to Iraq a couple months ago, and he visited Najaf, and he was the first Sunni leader talking to Sistani. So I think there is a new area that this strategic depth, so to speak, of Turkey can exploit, which is to avoid a Sunni-Shiite polarization. And Turkey's position on Syria, when you talk to Turkish officials, they always say that in Syria, what they were trying to do all along by engaging Assad was to contain Iran, to give basically Syria a chance to decouple itself from Tehran. It's another story whether Western officials believe that, because I think Middle East hands in Washington especially believe that this was naive, that Syria and Iran are too closely tied, and that Turkey will not be able to do that. But when you listen to Prime Minister Erdogan criticizing Assad, saying that we should not have another Hama in Syria, you get the sense that, as Steve said, Turkey is totally on the other opposite end of Iran, which is basically supporting the crackdown. So I think we have reached a point where Turks feel disillusioned, frustrated, disappointed with Iran. Iran has not really helped Turkey as a country that wanted to mediate on the nuclear issue. And I don't expect really Turkey playing the same role that it did in 2010 on the nuclear issue. I think Turks feel that they have received nothing from Iran for all their help.
Let me just add one thing. The relationship between Turkey and Iran clearly is a complex one. On the one hand, they are competing, and they're competing everywhere. And in Syria, we're seeing the first fissures emerge in a very open and direct way. But nonetheless, I think both countries will be careful not to take this too far so as to damage their commercial relations. I mean, for the Turks, the commercial relations, as insignificant as they may appear at the moment with Iran, are still potential, and Turkish business is very interested in going into Iran. But when you look at Iraq, for instance, on the economic side, there's a ferocious competition going on. Yes, on the political side, we saw, you know, when there was each government supported different candidates for the prime ministership. But when you go down and you look at the economic aspect, Turkey exports a great deal to Iraq, but so do the Iranians. And, you know, in that sense, it's a little bit of a zero-sum relationship there. And in Syria, you saw, yes, Ahmadinejad immediately congratulated Erdogan, but at the same time, the Iranian media has been complaining about a Turkish-Israeli-American plot to destabilize Bashar. So you do have essentially especially on Syria, you will see that the more the Turks criticize Bashar, the more Iran and Turkey will be going in different directions. I mean, Bashar had two friends, Erdogan and the Iranians. Looks like he has lost Erdogan. And in many ways, what's been happening in Syria has pushed Erdogan much more towards the United States and the Europeans, and people realize. And Erdogan talking about UN Security Council resolution on Syria, in my mind, is very critical. So there is going to be, if Syria continues on this path and certainly implodes, yes, there will be much more competition and much more, it will be tougher. Steve.
I'd like to pursue this a little bit further on the foreign policy aspect.
Steve, identify yourself.
Oh, Steve Larrabee, Rand. Steve, you said Egypt is back and that there will perhaps over the medium term be more competition. I think that assumption, at least I'm going to assert it, is questionable. In fact, I think Egypt is likely to be consumed and caught up in the domestic politics of transition, and it is not likely to be able to play that big a role in foreign policy. That's a, in the, I think it's questionable whether it is. Secondly, I would argue that, in fact, Turkey, given what's happened in the Middle East over the last 3 or 4 months, in fact, will have to reconsider and reshape its foreign policy towards the region. That foreign policy of no problems with the neighbors was predicated on the status quo remaining in, intact, and that the most of the leaders would still be there. That hasn't been the case. You've already had Mubarak gone. You have had Gaddafi on the ropes. I would say Assad on the ropes, and then Ben Ali also gone. This is a region, obviously, that's undergoing a great deal of change. So the point is, will they not? And then, of course, what's happening in Syria? In reaction to this, it seems to me, the Turks are going to have to rethink their policy towards the region. And again, I don't think Egypt is going to be able to play the role that it always has aspired to for a while.
Well, thanks for the question, Stephen. Thanks for the opportunity to plug my book that's coming out in September, October. I turn all your attention to the bio that was given out at the beginning. I disagree with your assertion of my assertion. Let me say that I do think that in the short run, clearly, as the title of the book suggests, that there's going to be a massive struggle in Egypt over what this country is, what it represents, and its relationship to the region. And let me just underline what I said, which was that if Egypt can become a more successful society, if Egyptians can overcome their competing legitimacies, which is what's going on in Egypt right now, you can read more about it, in a way that makes for a decent, open, freer political system and become economically successful, something Egypt was only for a very brief time, first under Nasser and then for a very short moment under Mubarak recently, it can play an important role. But even absent those things, there is a natural tendency for Arabs to look to Cairo for leadership. It is a center of cultural production, a center of learning, and so on and so forth. The competition has long been between Baghdad and Cairo. And I think that the Turks have a number of disadvantages in comparison. One, they're Turks. Two, they have a colonial legacy. And three, regardless of what orientation AKP has for the moment, it is a country that, for the better part of the last however many decades, has been largely a tepid observer of events in the region and not directly related. And these recent events demonstrate that it does not have that kind of special insight into the region that it purportedly has. You're going to get agreement from me in the sense that because of all this, they're absolutely going to have to retool their foreign policy. And as Omer was pointing out, they're going to have to think of some new way to relate to the region. My sense is that the enduring part of this very activist moment in Turkish foreign policy in the Middle East is going to be an economic one. And I think that that is likely the case. But I don't think that the Turkish prime minister, beyond the medium run, if it's not Erdogan, it's going to be hard for them to become a leader of the Arab street, because there will be a leader of the Arab street and it will be an Arab. It won't be some decrepit old former military officer who's waiting around to die to hand it off to his son. Yes.
Hi, Daphne McCarty from the Project on Middle East Democracy. One thing that struck me about these elections was how little the issue of secularism factored into the debate, which obviously stands in stark contrast to recent elections and even the referendum where CHP had posters with veiled women saying, if you vote yes, this is what will happen to the country. So I'm just wondering if this is an issue that is still in the debate at all, or if Turks are moving beyond this issue and, you know, to more substantive issues like the economy and things of that sort.
You're absolutely right, Daphne, that
secularism did not really appear as a major wedge issue in these elections. And I think it's partly because CHP, under the leadership of Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, made a conscious choice not to make secularism a constant issue. This was lesson learned from Deniz Baykal and the failure of the old CHP, which was always about fear-mongering and telling that Turkey was becoming like Iran, that basically we needed to save secularism. Instead, the CHP decided to have a much more project-oriented campaign where they talked about income disparity, the need to have better welfare services, and overall, I think this was a better strategy. Another reason why secularism did not really factor in this election is because I think people are tired of this issue in Turkey. And it was astonishing that in the middle of this campaign, you have a situation where 10% of active duty generals in the Turkish army are in either under investigation or behind bars. You had an active duty three-four-star general who was the leader of the National Academy, Military Academy, who was arrested and put behind bars. And yet you did not have really a memorandum coming from the military. You did not have really a major polarization on this issue. Even the question of Ergenekon, despite CHP's slight flirtation with the issues, trying to say we are the advocate of Ergenekon, did not really factor in. The media did not buy the story. People are, I think, tired of these kind of issues. This may still polarize the debate in Western capitals about Turkey, but I think in large part in the Turkish street, in Anatolia especially, people are more interested about bread and butter economic issues. And there is, however, a different discussion. It's not about secularism, but it's about whether Turkey is becoming more authoritarian. And that the press freedom debate is, I think, important. And that, to a certain degree, was there in the election, but not as much as in the West. There is a Western perception where there's a story where, despite this Turkish model, the beauty of this model, when NPR, for instance, had a very long discussion on Turkey, they talked a long time about journalists in jail, and that all is not well with Turkish democracy, and there was this question whether one type of authoritarianism in Turkey is being replaced by another type of authoritarianism. That was not secularism at the heart of the issue, but it was essentially whether Turkey was moving towards a more authoritarian system. And that's why the presidential debate was important, whether Erdogan would push for a presidential regime. Because if there is one thing that Turkey does not absolutely need, is more centralization, more power in the hands of one man. I don't think we have much evidence to argue that Erdogan is pursuing an autocratic agenda. But there are concerns about AKP's understanding of democracy, that essentially it's a majoritarian understanding of democracy that doesn't look really at the minority rights very favorably. His rhetoric on the Kurdish question was the big issue there, but also gender issues, his take on women created doubts. And this is why people in the Western media wanted CHP, a strong showing for the CHP, so that there would be a strong checks and balance at the parliament, not the military, not the judiciary, which were basically playing that role in the past, but a civilian opposition, CHP and MHP. So it was not secularism, but authoritarianism that was, I think, partly in the election as a wedge issue.
I'm Regan Updegraff from the National Endowment for Democracy. I wanted to ask you about a Pew poll that came out actually just a week before the election showing that 48% of Turks agreed with the direction the country was taking while 49% disagreed. That more or less corresponds with like the 50% election result that AKP received. So my question is this, like, can the AKP grow its votes beyond 50%, or is it to some degree maxed out? And also, like, if it were to grow its votes, it seems like the issue where it can make the most headway is the Kurdish issue. But at the same time, given the fact that the AKP has been accusing the BDP and the PKK of turning Kurds into Zoroastrians and everything else. What likelihood does the AKP actually have in terms of bridging that divide with Kurds, especially given the constitutional, especially in the context of the constitution?
It's a difficult question to answer. I mean, presumably, if the economy continues to perform well and there's progress along a new constitution, and it's not very divisive. And let me add, in terms of your question, in terms of secularism, the one big issue that may come up in the context of the secularism is the headscarf issue, and whether because AKP will try to revisit that issue and try to see it as a way in which the ban on the headscarf can be lifted through the process of a new constitution, and that may again give rise to the secularism issue. But let's assume for one moment that things are going relatively well on all of these fronts. AKP may grow its votes, but it will come at the expense of the nationalists. It could have done this time around, but as I said in my presentation, it made certain mistakes and allowed the MHP to survive. But in the end, MHP really doesn't have much of a real institutional base to stand on, except for this one idea of Turkish nationalism. And if, as a result, and we're talking about another 4 years, there's time for the AKP to whittle away at the MHP vote and essentially force it out, and therefore it will grow. That said, I would argue, I would add one more thing. The one, shall we say, negative aspect of the situation in Turkey now is the extent to which Tayyip Erdogan has become the dominant political actor. He's everything now. And people vote for him as much as they vote for the party. So if in 4 years from now, he's no longer there because he decided to, he doesn't want to be in Turkish politics anymore. Maybe he wants to become the General Secretary of the United Nations. I don't know. Or retire someplace. But the point is, what would happen to the AKP without his dominant personality there? He's a masterful politician, and there is nobody else in the party who comes near him in that. There's no obvious successor to him. And in a way, AKP may go the way some of the most dominant Turkish, what happens to political parties after a dominant leader disappears. After Atatürk disappeared, CHP essentially also suffered. After Özal, even during Özal's time, his party suffered a great deal when he became president of the Republic and left the party. So without a dominant person like that, there's a very good possibility that AKP will suffer. So, and maybe other parties will emerge. And one final thought on this. It also depends on what kind of electoral system they'll come up with after this constitution. So we don't know. Yes.
Jason Epstein. Henri, you almost answered my question before I asked it.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Better job.
Assuming that AKP doesn't splinter apart in the future, and regardless of whether CHP can become this mass party, what I think has been not talked about but hinted at is the demise of the other parties from 2002, when DYP was, what, five tenths of a percentage point from from being in parliament, maybe being in a coalition with AKP, to looking at the election results and seeing 0.25%. I think Sadet was under 2%, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk a little bit more, and maybe Omer, if you could do it as well, talk about what are their futures? Are these parties destined to become extinct? Would there have to be a new creation like AKP was created out of the ashes? Thanks.
Look, I again, Turkey is going to go through, I mean, I'm stating that Turkey is going to go through a reform process. Part of that reform process will include more than the Constitution, will include all the laws that emanate from the Constitution. That includes electoral laws. That includes political party laws. That includes every aspect of essentially political activity, freedom of speech, and so on and so forth. The current system makes the party leader the single most important individual in the party. And it doesn't matter. You can't dislodge a party leader unless you find some sex tape. It's very difficult. When somebody becomes a party leader, he or she, and so mostly it's been he except for Tan Sonum, you haven't been able to dislodge them. But all of this stuff, it's changed as a result of the reform process. I don't know what kind of parties will emerge. I don't know what's going to happen to internal party democracy, because there is none at the moment. So I think the future is very murky. New parties may emerge. These may consolidate. These may transform themselves. So it's very difficult to say, and Jason, I'm sorry.
Obviously, if in Turkey you had a 5% threshold for representation in the parliament, you would have a different set of political parties making it to the parliament. BDP would be in the parliament as BDP, not with independents. Maybe parties like ANAP, Motherland, or True Patriots would not be extinguished. But beyond this structural defect of Turkish democracy, the Turkish electoral system, which is this embarrassingly high 10% threshold, which is not acceptable and hopefully will be corrected soon, there is the problem of AKP being a formidable political machine that doesn't leave much space in the left or in the right. Because this is a conservative party, and you would think that a conservative party would have a social democratic opponent on the left that would challenge the conservative right-wing agenda of AKP. But AKP not only benefits from the CHP's inefficiency, but also it is a kind of social democratic populist left-wing party when it comes to its populist welfare state narrative. So it doesn't leave much space in the left for the emergence of a populist welfare state oriented political party, because it is doing all these things with better healthcare, affordable housing, more efficient services at the municipality level. It is also a political party that is, despite being in power for 9 years now, is able to play the narrative of victimhood. That's the difference between Turkey and Russia. In this city especially, a lot of people compare Erdogan and Putin. In Putin, you have the KGB himself in power. In Erdogan, you have the opposition to the Turkish deep state in power. In Erdogan, you have someone who is in charge of the country, but who's not the state. He still identifies himself with the downtrodden, with the periphery, with the people. Now, some may argue that this is a romantic view of the old AKP, because AKP is becoming the state. And that's true, too. There are more bureaucratic elements. There is patronage, kadrolaşma, as we say it in Turkey. But still, the ideology of this political party, when we call it a formerly Islamic, moderately Islamic, neo-Islamic, the fact that it has the term Islam in it makes it a different animal than Russia, KGB, Putin, etc. It is able to play the narrative of victimhood. And still, after all these years, project its victory as the victory of the people against the regime, against the deep state. That's a formidable thing. Those are the reasons why I think it will be very hard to challenge the AKP. The only alternative to the AKP will come from AKP itself, if the party divides.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Cameron Tybus from the University of Oxford. All of you have mentioned that a lot of AKP's popularity is predicated on their economic success. And I understand that growth rates make for popular parties. What I don't understand is what I understand to be quite high unemployment rates, especially in the youth sector. Why doesn't that temper enthusiasm? I mean, not all the economic indicators coming out of Turkey are good. So, and also there's the problem of just building up youth angst. So how does that play into all this, and why is that not a factor?
I'll jump in very quickly. I'll leave it to my two Marxist-oriented colleagues to explain that. I actually don't believe that it's predicated solely or mainly on economic success. I think certainly economic success plays a big role. But what Omer just talked about, I think, is important, that the narratives, there's a certain power of ideas that AKP, in its foreign policy, there are a number of animating ideas about, you know, Turkey is a very insular country that looks upon the world as being against it in many ways, and AKP has taken that and turned it into a narrative in which it mints political gold. And I think in addition to that, the whole notion of transforming Turkey's traditional culture wars into issues of freedom of expression and personal freedoms has been genius in ideas that resonate with large numbers of Turks. Certainly, though, you know, the very positive economic news has helped AKP. And I'm interested in hearing from Omer and Henri why, as you point out, there is a pretty consistent and rather high unemployment problem, why it has not suffered from. To me, having taken a lot of economics, but I can't divide, the most important things in these countries are the narratives that their leaders are able to weave and how they resonate with people. And I think that AKP has been amazing. Just an anecdote. I don't know how many of you are on Egemen Bash's email distribution list. I am. I think I'm one of many millions. Hopefully I'm, number one or two on the list. And he, on the eve of the election, he blasted out one of his things. He said, it's either a vote for us or the status quo. And I said, this is amazing. 9 years later, aren't they the status quo? But no. And so I think that, you know, this type of stuff is really from my kind of consumption. But if that is the message, and that is the message, it is one that I think deeply resonates with kind of insular nationalist Turks and in against the backdrop of everything that AKP has been able to achieve, even with this kind of economic problem that remains persistent. Marx, Engels, what would you like to?
Come on, now that we've heard from Mussolini, but. Engels, you want to go?
I'm a Trotskyist. Comrade Henri, are you sure you don't want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll go after you.
Okay. I think there is high unemployment in Turkey, but there is also something that you cannot see in the statistics, which is the gray economy. There is a very large gray economy where part of the people who are reported as unemployed are actually employed. And the gray economy is not getting smaller, it's actually growing in Turkey because tax evasion is a national hobby and people basically underreport, and you have this booming gray economy where a lot of young people, not skilled, are finding basically, I think, not recorded jobs. Also, I think when you look at the voter profile, the youth tends to vote more for the CHP. You have a situation where I think there is some discontent at the level of the youth, and especially urban youth. There is an urban-rural divide to a certain degree, masked by the preponderance of Istanbul, because Istanbul is the big story. But down the line, when you look at the demographic dynamics of Turkey, as urbanization grows up, as urbanization increases, this will favor, I think, a political party like CHP that has this image of a kind of progressive social democratic party. If it could really shed its image as a pro-status quo, pro-state party, but can become like the new Labour that Tony Blair changed, it can be, our colleague Soner Çağatay often talks about the new Kemalism. If there could be really a neo-Kemalism, it would be even better if they would drop Kemalism and figure out basically a new narrative. That would basically appeal more to the bread and butter issues, oriented issues of the youth. But don't underestimate the gray economy. A lot of youth find jobs in Turkey. You have a situation where the figures of unemployment may be too high than what they seem.
I just want to add one thing. First of all, the election results show that it's only 50% that vote for AKP. So there is a large chunk of people who voted for some for economic reasons, maybe because they couldn't get jobs, some for cultural issues, ideology. So it's not as if AKP is winning 80% of the vote, and then so there is, okay. But when you look at the map, the only industrialized part of Turkey that voted for CHP is Izmir, right? And that's been consistent. I mean, and they vote more on secular issues rather than on the questions of workers' rights and on these kinds of issues. So Istanbul, which is the most industrialized part still, is still solidly and has been solidly in the hands of AKP. And one of the things that you have to remember, it's not just youth unemployment that's a factor, but it's also the question that AKP has made it part of its its slogan, but also the reality. It brings services. I mean, they want Erdogan and his people keep stressing one thing over and over again: we are here to serve you. This is, you will say, is rhetoric, but remember, this is the kind of rhetoric that was never used by a political party. And the problem is that CHP has not made that transition. I mean, CHP has always been the party of the state. As I said earlier, campaigns are from 30,000 feet. And AKP, by contrast, knows exactly who lives where, in what house, what are their needs, what are their, they have, and it goes, it's not, it didn't start, by the way, with AKP. It started with its predecessor, two predecessors, the Welfare Party. I remember in 94, looking at the Welfare Party, they had, even in those days, they had computerized lists of people who lived where. So there's a completely different approach, and you cannot discount that. Yes, there may not be enough employment, but there's many other things that are okay. Tom.
Thanks. I'm Tom Duval here at Carnegie. Can I ask you to speculate a bit more about AKP and the new constitution? What are their options? Who are they going to talk to? What are their priorities? Omer was saying that Erdogan isn't Putin, but there was a presumption that he had a kind of Putinist project through the new constitution. That obviously... He probably won't be able to achieve that now. So what does he try and do instead, and who does he try and do it with?
Very quickly, look, Erdogan wanted, I mean, at least he didn't tell me, and I don't think he's told many people, so we don't really know. We surmise that he wanted a French-style presidential system. When you look at some of the purges he conducted even within his party before the election, you get the sense that he purged people who would have opposed him, because there's a great deal of opposition to this presidential system. I mean, this system in Turkey, yes, there's been all these military coups, yes, there's been, it's imperfect, but people are accustomed to this political system and they know how it works, they instinctively understand it. And you see a great deal of sophistication on the part of the Turkish voter. Turks take their voting very seriously and expect that change can be implemented through the ballot box. I mean, in that sense, it's a very mature democracy. That said, changing and bringing something that's quite alien at this stage is, I think, is seen as being very problematic. Especially now that he doesn't have as a commanding majority in parliament as he may have hoped, in terms of dominating the discourse and narrative on this issue, if he loads up too many things onto the constitutional project, i.e. democratization, the Kurdish question, maybe redefining secularism, and on top of that, the presidential system, then... The whole project may go down in flames. So he's going to have to accommodate. The constitution, when change, may end up, as Omer hinted, not in terms of a French-style presidential system, but a president with more enhanced powers. Already, I mean, the Turks did a constitutional change a few years ago where they changed the next presidential election. It doesn't matter what. And under the current system, is for the first time will be through direct election. The president will be elected by the public, which is a bad idea if I've ever seen one. Because you will have, at the end of this, a president who's been elected by popular suffrage, a prime minister who's been elected by popular suffrage, except the way the Turkish system works is that it's quite possible that the prime minister will get, or his party will get, less than 50% of the vote. But the president, by virtue of the way the system is set up, will have more than 50%. So you're creating a dynamic of conflict, if you want, between two institutions, where even if the president is not that empowered, he will say, well, I got more votes than you did, so you should listen to me. So already they have the seeds of a major problem there. And if they load more powers to the presidency, and you bring in somebody as dominant to there as Erdogan, I think it's going to augur very poorly for the future of the Turkish system. That's why I believe that in the end he's not going to. The constitutional changes will go through, but not much will be done to the presidency.
I think more than the presidency, the real issue will be how to embrace the opposition on the Kurdish question. The presidency in this constitutional reform agenda may not really rank very high in terms of the real discussion. The urgent issue is how to deal with the civil disobedience campaign of the PKK and BDP supporting this. Can the BDP be a partner for Erdogan in this Kurdish question, in bringing reforms on the question of citizenship? My hunch is that Erdogan, having adopted this kind of nationalist narrative, condemning the BDP for not distancing itself from the PKK terrorism, will find in the CHP a partner, especially elements within the CHP, such as the new Kurdish wing of the party, symbolized by Sezgin Tanrıkulu, who was head of the Bar Association in Diyarbakır, who is a respected name within the Kurdish movement, who is able to take a certain distance to the PKK. He may be a partner in terms of talking about the reforms that will be needed on the citizenship issue, on the question of education, bilingual education, political decentralization. And let's face it, I mean, this is a big victory despite the fact that AKP does not have 367, they have 326. How many more votes do they need to have 330? Four more votes to pass basically an amendment to the Constitution and presenting it to a referendum. So they don't need much in terms of opposition support to amend or change the Constitution. It's the referendum that will really matter. And on the referendum, I think Erdogan will be a much more conciliatory figure compared to what we have seen on the Kurdish question, because I think the heart of the new constitution will be about the Kurdish question and not the presidential regime, not the presidential prospects. I think the presidential ambitions of Erdogan with a kind of semi-presidential system like the French Fifth Republic are gone now. This is over. He would have pursued that if he had 370 votes, but now he won't.
Yes. Over there, though.
Thank you. Hi, Peter Fetner. I'm wondering if the success of the Kurdish party is going to encourage them to contact Kurds outside of Turkey, form alliances with them, and start to work, with them against Turkey, even against Iran, if they're going to use this as an opportunity to pursue their own goals.
Well, first of all, they've been the Turkish Kurds and especially Iraqi Kurds have been in dialogue for a very, very long time, and they've been very influenced by what has happened in Iraq. That said, historically speaking, I mean, Iraqi Kurds have had an influence on Turkish Kurds, but this victory does not necessarily mean that the Turkish Kurds are now going to try to create a pan-Kurdish state or etc. In fact, when you look at what the Iraqi Kurds have been telling the Turkish Kurds is to essentially to ratchet down the rhetoric, to compromise with the AKP. In fact, they've told the Turkish Kurds who continuously come and seek advice and support from the people like the Iraqi President Talabani or Mr. Barzani, the head of the Kurdistan regional government, what they've been told consistently is AKP is a major opportunity for you to resolve your problems democratically. The issue has to be solved democratically, politically, and not through the barrel of the gun. So in many ways, the message that is coming from Iraq is a message of conciliation and one of work with the AKP. That's one. Number two, I actually think that the success of the Turkish Kurds, and this has been actually in evidence now for a while, is also an indication that the Turkish Kurds are no longer interested in independence. In fact, they want to work through the system. They want to get essentially three things. They want to get a change in the constitution, cultural autonomy, that is to say, the ability to teach, ability to use language without interference from the state, and some kind of decentralization of the state, not just of Turkey, not just for their regions, but also for the rest of the country. I mean, it helps the people in Izmir as much as it helps people in Diyarbakir. Those are the three essential demands. Right, and today you cannot talk about a Kurdish problem that is regional. Kurds number in Istanbul between 2 to 4 million. So Istanbul is the largest Kurdish city in the world. On top of that, Kurds maybe are close to a majority in Adana and in Mersin. So you no longer have essentially a Kurdish problem that was very regional, southeast and the east. It's now all over the country. So what kind of separation are you going to have what kind of state are you going to have if you push for separation? So it doesn't really make sense from that perspective. And you've seen this, the evolution of thinking among the Kurds and certainly within the BDP as well. So I don't see it. On the contrary, I think the results are a vote in the other direction. Yes. Maybe that's the last question.
Hi, Matthew O'Sullivan from the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. If the Syrian refugee crisis along Turkey's border continues to worsen, might that push Turkey's government to take a stronger standpoint on the current events happening right next door? Or might it at least push foreign policy and foreign affairs closer to center stage for Turkish voters?
Well, it's not going to push it closer to center stage for Turkish voters because Turkish voters just voted. So, but it will become a major issue, and will, to the extent that you have Syrians trying to pour over the border, this is a significant not only diplomatic challenge for Ankara, but a significant humanitarian challenge for Ankara. What it does, though, in the broader scheme of Turkish foreign policy is, as I said, I think it is a clarifying moment about where exactly Turkey stands on this issue. And I think that for a long time, Ankara was under the impression that it had the kind of influence to sway the Assads away from Iran. And I've, for one of those people who never bought this argument. Not that they weren't, not that the Turks didn't believe it themselves, but that Assad was never going to give up Tehran because he knew that that was really the only place in a crisis he could rely on. And in fact, that's what's coming to pass. So I think that the Turks have been too slow, but ultimately have gotten to the point where they now can foresee, although they are hedging, as Omer pointed out, they can foresee a post-Assad period and will clearly have a role in trying to manage that issue. And as a result, it will become more of a front and center issue for Turkey and a Turkish domestic political issue if you have more and more Syrians seeking safe haven in Turkey. And that's a natural place, at least for people in the northern third of the country, to go. They are not beyond the reach of the Syrians in Lebanon. They're certainly not going to pour over the border into Israel. And why would you want to go to Iraq? So clearly, Turkey is the place that they're going to head.
Let me thank you all for coming. And also, let me end by plugging Mussolini's upcoming book.
Gramsci.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you again. And